Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of R2V3 lessons learned. My name's Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS program manager with PJR. I have a brief agenda on today's slide to give you an idea of what we'll be covering today. I'll cover a little bit about Perry Johnson Registrars, who we are, what we do. We'll cover some of the benefits of certification at a high level, and then we'll get into the content of today's webinar, primarily the most common NCRs that we have seen over the last year or so of auditing to the new standard, as well as some general lessons learned that we can share with our client base. We'll close with an overview of the certification process for anyone who is pursuing certification for the first time and not familiar with that process, and we'll close with questions at the end. And I want to reiterate right at the beginning of the webinar that today's webinar and the webinars that PJR offers are meant to assist our clients and provide information and things that we've learned. However, CIRI has a formal website, the knowledge base for housing a number of R2V3 articles, training, formal interpretations, reference documents, all of which clients should be referencing and utilizing in a more formal capacity than our webinars. Certainly, no formal training certificate comes out of the webinar that we're doing today. We're just, again, trying to share some information with our clients. Feel free to reference the CIRI website for more official information. PJR is one of the leading registrars in the world. We've certified companies around the globe to a number of certification standards. This is not an all-inclusive list of countries in which we've certified clients. However, it does give a sense of our global presence as a certification body. PJR is accredited to grant certification for a wide variety of standards, including R2, which is what we are discussing today. Benefits of certification vary by standard and by organization. Not really the point of today's webinar, so I'm not going to spend long on this, but certainly you can review the contents of the slide on your own if you are trying to determine whether certification is right for your organization. Certainly, the standard represents a commitment to responsible reuse and recycling of electronics, and implementing and maintaining the standard requirements can help drive a number of improvements, including environmental health and safety performance, employee engagement, and there can be opportunities for competitive advantages and improvements to public image as well. So without further ado, we have compiled at PJR data as far as the nature and types of NCRs that have been issued over the course of the last almost year and a half now of auditing to the R2V3 standard. This is certainly not an all-inclusive list, and the requirements and NCRs vary widely. So in order to not get too facility specific, I've tried to keep the nature of the findings pretty general, and we'll just talk about the requirements at a high level. This may serve as a reminder for the majority of organizations, but there are some lessons to be learned here to be sure. So I'll go through some of these common NCRs, again, not an all-inclusive list, and we can always answer some more specific questions towards the end of the webinar. Appendix A is one of the most common sources of NCRs for R2V3 audits. Oh, I do also want to note Note that these are not in any particular order, so I have not listed them in order of frequency. I've kind of gone alphabetically and numerically instead. So Appendix A is one of the most common requirements against which we see NCRs having been written over the last year and a half. This could be for a number of requirements, as of course, Appendix A is rather lengthy. But to generalize the nature of the findings, we see themes related to incomplete records of downstream due diligence to the R2v3 standard requirements. And that's kind of a catch-all that includes a number of gaps. If any of those, required downstream records are not there, it would fall in this category. If downstream vendors were not included in the qualification process, but they were shipped material, that would fall under this category as well. If the subsequent tiers were not vetted and only the first tier was vetted and they're not R2v3, then that would also fall into this category. So the incomplete due diligence is a very broad generalization, but that was probably the most common NCR that we've seen, and that is, I would say that tracks. That is very similar to the trends for R2 2013 as well. Gaps in downstream due diligence being one of the most common findings written. We also see under Appendix A theme for misidentifying downstream vendors. As we should all know, in the R2v3 standard, Appendix A specifies that due diligence qualification requirements vary depending on whether the tier one is R2v3 or non-R2 certified. And the standard is making a distinction between whether the tier one is R2v3 or not R2v3. If a downstream vendor is still R2 2013 certified, they would fall under that non-R2 category. That would not, they're not R2v3 certified yet. They haven't had their transition audit yet. They need to be categorized as non-R2. So that's another common error that we do uncover, excuse me, through the course of the R2v3 audits as we look at the downstream due diligence evidence there. That's important not only for downstream vendor qualification evidence, but also the number of downstream vendors and whether or not they are R2v3 certified is also a factor in audit time determination or calculation. So having misclassified those downstream vendors also affects audit time, and we're required to, in many cases, make up that audit time if it was short because of a miscalculation and a miscounting of the downstream vendors. So, continuing along with downstream due diligence, making sure that the downstream vendors are qualified as required based on whether or not they're R2v3 certified, but also the section of Appendix A that elaborates on what due diligence is required if they're not R2v3 certified. It goes on to talk about the respective appendices. So let's say your tier one is R2 2013 certified or not R2 at all, they're treated the same, and you're sending material to be refurbished, repaired. Have you vetted that downstream vendor against the Appendix A requirements and also the Appendix C requirements, because we have to keep the material within the R2v3 requirements. If you're not fulfilling Appendix C in-house in part or in its entirety, and you're sending it to a downstream vendor who will, those Appendix C requirements then need to be maintained through that downstream vendor. That downstream vendor may or may not be R2 certified, but the verbiage is in Appendix A to apply the relevant appendices to the downstream vendors based on the types of material you're sending them and the scope of work that you're expecting them to fulfill. So that won't apply to everyone. Another example would be when you're sending electronics or electronic components, maybe the circuit boards, to a ultimately to an end-of-life facility has that smelter or, you know, whatever the case may be, been vetted to the Appendix E requirements for materials recovery. Pollution liability is also covered in Appendix A as far as the need to have pollution liability insurance if your organization is processing negative value equipment. And this is a new concept in R2v3, so I encourage you to get familiar with that terminology if you're not already, and understand that the verbiage in Appendix E, also talking about pollution liability insurance, allows for other types of evidence, including financial reserves or guarantees, and isn't specific to negative value equipment. But when we're looking at just Appendix A, if your facility processes negative value equipment, we're automatically looking for that pollution liability insurance coverage because that's how the appendix is written. Appendix B is another common area for NCRs, and I've tried to generalize these because, again, this looks very different for a number of reasons. So if a recycler qualifies for Appendix B based on their processes, maybe it's logical sanitization, maybe it's physical destruction, maybe it's both. Common themes for NCRs written against Appendix B include gaps in the processes itself, so not meeting all of the requirements in Appendix B, and there are a whole host of them, so I've kept that pretty vague, making sure that all of the Appendix B requirements are being adhered to. We also sometimes see incomplete documentation of the process requirements. So does the data sanitization plan or the data security policy address all of the requirements of Appendix B? There are typically holes. I've listed some examples, but again, not an all-inclusive list. The need to use software for sanitization. So this isn't a factory reset that we're talking about here, but actually utilizing software, that terminology is used in the standard for a reason. Maintaining recordings of physical destruction, whether the destruction types meet the table requirements or the allowed options specified in Appendix B. Maintaining unique identifiers, making sure that, again, the documented data sanitization plan meets all of the requirements of Appendix B. The training and competency requirements of Appendix B. So those are some of the examples, some of the common themes I was seeing in that data. And again, there's a number of requirements in Appendix B. So rather than, you know, break down the whole appendix now, I wanted to cover that at a high level. Appendix C is another common area for NCRs for clients who qualify for Appendix C. Again, this could be the concept of the processes not meeting all of the criteria spelled out in the appendix, and or the documented processes not checking all the boxes, not meeting all of the specified requirements in the appendix. Some examples might include maintaining individualized records for each item and each functionality tested. Have all types of electronics or media been accounted for within the process? Is there a documented process for testing all of the types of equipment that come through the door or could reasonably be expected to come through the door? Does the reuse plan check all the Appendix C boxes? Those are some examples. Moving on to the core requirements, again, these are not in order of frequency. Core requirement one, we see themes related to ensuring all of the appropriate and relevant names are included in certification. And again, this is as relevant, this isn't going to apply to all organizations, but if the name, if there are various names being utilized and that they fall within the requirements of core requirement one to need to be included in the scope of certification, not doing so obviously results in nonconformities that affects the SIRI license, that affects the contract with a certification body to conduct your audits. It affects the names listed on the certificate. It affects the advertising of certification. So ensuring all relevant names are disclosed and utilized appropriately and advertised accordingly are all important. It's also important to make sure that the appropriate facility scheme is identified and utilized. So this comes from the code of practice specifically, but it's relevant to the scope and the certification scheme. Whether you disclose, co-located electronics recyclers in the building, if you are transparent about facilities that work together to fulfill the scope, have they been included in certification if required? Are they operating as a campus, or are they actually operating as individual or single facility schemes according to the R2V3 definitions? All of those things affect the way audits are approached and how audit time is calculated, how the final certificate will be issued, how the SIRI license is maintained. There are a number of impacts there as well. So making sure the scheme is appropriate is important. The scope itself is subject to specific verbiage requirements. Again, this comes from the code of practices. Ensuring that it is as accurate as possible, inclusive of all relevant appendices and not including irrelevant appendices, things like that. So the scope is very important and that falls under core one. Another common source of NCR is from core requirement three, ensuring that the risk assessments or the exposure evaluations and subsequent monitoring evidence meet the requirements for the relevant hazards or substances, depending on the types of material and processes being conducted at the facility. Core requirement five, a common NCR we see relates to incomplete summaries of transactions, whether it's that not all inbound and outbound materials are accounted for, or that a process isn't in place to maintain those summaries of transactions. This could be, either type of finding that they are incomplete or that they're not. There's not a process for maintaining those. So it's important to review that section, everything that needs to be included in the summaries of transactions, and having an effective process to ensure that that's going on in real time. Core requirement six is another very common source of NCRs for a number of reasons, and I'll try and keep this as general as possible. Again, the concept that the processes in place or sampled or observed by the auditor don't meet all the requirements of core requirement six. Another possibility would be that the documented processes don't check all the boxes. They don't touch on all of the expectations of core requirement six. They don't document how they'll meet all of the requirements of core requirement six. Could also be that the auditor's sampling is not in alignment with the documented processes. So if they say you'll do one thing and auditors observe the material being handled in a different, conflicting manner, that would be an issue under core six as well. Some examples include the appropriateness of the categories used in core six to not only identify the next processing method, but also to incorporate the REC categories. the adequacy or availability of test records. Again, this is not specific to core, to Appendix C. We're talking core requirement 6 here, for which everyone would be subject to demonstrating. So even if you're not qualifying for Appendix C, if you're not doing the testing in-house, there are still relevant requirements in core requirement 6 that would still be a requirement for the facility, such as maintaining or obtaining copies of test records if the upstream is responsible for the testing. Again, all of this comes back to ensuring that the materials are sorted, categorized, processed, and sent out in ways that agree with the R2v3 requirements and pathways. I touched on the sorting for subsequent processing. I touched on the incorporation of the REC requirements. There are instances where sampling is required. So if an upstream is doing the wiping or doing the testing, and they are not sending records, like uniquely identified records for each device, for each functionality, then sampling is required. And this also ties back into making sure the appropriate appendices are being met if you're going to be doing that sampling. So there is a lot of information in Core 6. There are a number of pathways, a number of ways that material could flow through Core 6. And it's really important to just reference that section routinely as you're building your processes, as you're documenting your plans, to make sure that nothing is falling out of the R2v3 funnel in a way that it shouldn't. And that, again, the documented processes are inclusive of all of the types of equipment that could come through and all of the Core 6 requirements that the audit is going to be subject to. Another common source of NCRs is Core Requirement 7. So again, here everyone is subject to Core Requirement 7, although on the other hand, not everyone is necessarily subject to Appendix B. So when we're talking Core 7, we're talking about the general requirements for all R2v3 facilities. Are the processes sampled meeting the requirements of Core 7? Are the documented processes checking all the boxes or meeting all of the requirements in Core Requirement 7, whether we're talking the data sanitization plan or the data security policy or both? Do they contain all of the prompted expectations to meet Core 7? Other examples might include gaps in training, making sure that all pre-sanitized media is controlled and identified appropriately. This includes, you know, when you look at the REC and you look at the sorting tables or the applicability tables, it helps guide your next processing steps. Pre-sanitized would be instances where the status is unknown or the status has been confirmed and the media still contains data and requires sanitization. So it's important to capture all of those pre-sanitized media accordingly for not only security reasons, but also to ensure that they're processed appropriately given the various Core 7 requirements. And this includes not miscategorizing items as non-data unless they check all those Core 6 boxes we were just talking about. So an example might be, if an upstream is doing the sanitization, but they're not R2v3 certified and they're not sending individualized records for each device and being able to demonstrate the data sanitization was successful, then we're not, the standard doesn't allow that to be recognized as pre-sanitized. As non-data, that would fall under pre-sanitized, and it needs to be controlled accordingly, whether that is 100% sanitization by the R2V3 recycler, whether it's sampling by the R2V3 recycler, whether it is securing the material and vetting a downstream vendor who's certified to Appendix B or can meet the Appendix B requirements on your behalf. There's a number of pathways as long as we're making sure it's not falling out of that R2V3 funnel. Other core 7 requirements against which the findings have been written were missing acknowledgments for employees with data security clearance and responsibility for core requirement 7, insufficient security controls. Again, take a look at everything that core 7 requires and make sure your process is built accordingly. The need for independent data audits. Those are some examples of the specific NCRs written. The last core requirement we'll talk about in terms of being more commonly cited for NCRs is core requirement 9. Core requirement 9 houses a number of requirements, including closure plan, insurance, we see again in core requirement 9. So having gaps or deficiencies in the closure plan, just as in R2 2013, continues to be an issue. There are a number of requirements that could fall into that category. Is a independent closure administrator not identified? Are funds not allocated in a way that the financial instrument requirements are met? Again, those are no less stringent than in R2 2013. So the same requirements, if not more stringent requirements, apply in R2V3. Does the independent administrator have access to the funds? Is the closure plan kept up to date? Does it account for all of the types of equipment being processed and ensure that appropriate companies will be utilized to process the electronic equipment in the event of closure or abandonment? The financial instrument continues to be a common source of NCRs. Does it meet the requirements for what types of financial instruments would be allowed? This means not trying to utilize the value of electronics or company-owned assets outright, saying that they'll be sold and the proceeds will be used. That even in R2 2013, the requirements and the guidance published by SERI required that those funds be legally bound to that purpose or used to secure a surety bond or something of that nature. There are a number of ways that the financial instrument requirement can be met. In some instances, pollution insurance coverages will even allow for this type of contingency. There are a number of ways in which the requirement can be met, but it is still a very common source of NCR. In R2V3, there are exceptions for recyclers who may not need to demonstrate a financial instrument, but those exceptions or those exemptions, all of the exemptions need to be met. So a company would have to check all 3 boxes, not just 1 or 2 of the 3. They would have to fall into the category where they truly qualify for that exemption and can produce evidence accordingly. So those are the common areas for core requirement 9. Insurance in general, not even just related to pollution liability that we talked about earlier, the more general insurance requirements are touched on again in core requirement 9. There were even findings against a lack of workers' compensation, but I wouldn't say that those are necessarily common. So just ensuring when we're talking about core requirement 9 that the insurance is appropriate given the scope of activities, the types of electronics, the size and location of the organization. There are a number of factors there. And then where specified elsewhere in the standard, like in Appendix A for negative value equipment requiring pollution liability insurance, that the insurance requirements are fulfilled. So at a high level, those are the most common NCRs or the themes in NCRs that are data revealed. And we will keep the webinar content and the slides up to date as that changes as we continue to conduct our two audits and maybe those frequencies shift a bit and other areas come to light as more common. We'll keep that information updated. I also have a slide here talking about some of the lessons learned, and I've kept this again very, very brief. This varies so much by organization, and I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about things that aren't relevant to the majority of attendees. So I'm going to touch on them at a high level, and if we have specific questions and time allows, we can look at them in more detail. Some of the lessons learned over the course of implementing and transitioning even our own systems to meet the R2v3 criteria, and then, like I said, having conducted these R2v3 audits over the last year and a half or so, these are some of the things that we've learned as a certification body and want to stress the importance of to our clients as well. Having the appendices identified correctly is very important, not only for the auditing process and the efficiency of the audits, but also the calculation of the audit time. We need to make sure that the scope is accurate and relevant, and we do that by, in part, by identifying the applicable appendices. There's a direct correlation to the appendices and the audit time as well. So, understanding the appendices and identifying which are appropriate to your business are of significant importance. SIRI's knowledge base that I mentioned earlier in the presentation, their website has a number of resources related to appendix applicability or understanding the process requirements and whether they would be relevant to the organization. There's a scope determination tool, and or an appendix applicability tool that I find really helpful. It breaks down each appendix and goes through scenarios in which an organization would or would not require or qualify for that appendix. So I encourage everyone who's unclear to maybe explore that tool, maintain a copy of the PDF as a handy reference as you're going through process of implementing the new standard or transitioning your system, filling out your application to understand which appendices may apply. And the appendices will be verified not only during each audit, but prior to your transition or stage two, one for R2v3, we conduct a contract validation activity, which we'll talk about shortly. And that's an opportunity for us to also work with you to confirm the appendices are appropriate before the audit actually takes place and have an opportunity to adjust audit time if an appendix was identified to be missing or not needed. QMS certification is required for some of the appendices. This is new to R2v3, and there's been quite a learning curve associated with this concept too. So if your organization qualifies for Appendix C, D, and or F, a quality management system certification is required in addition to the EHS certifications. What this means is if you don't already have ISO 9001 certification or RIO certification, or one of the other recognized QMS certifications on the SIRI website, and you are qualifying for one of those appendices, you'll actually need to achieve certification to the QMS prior to receiving an R2v3 certification or qualifying for R2v3 transition. Again, this is where ensuring the appendices are appropriate and accurate is important. It would be a shame to pursue QMS certification thinking you qualified for example, Appendix C, only to find out that you don't actually need or qualify for Appendix C. So this is really important as well. For those of you planning to transition or pursue initial certification, this is something that you should look into sooner rather than later. We continue to work through nuances with scope. The verbiage is specified by the code of practice, and it is related to which appendices a facility qualifies for and the types of electronics they process. There is a learning curve here. As I mentioned, companies are, of course, used to being able to specify, at least to a degree, what their scope reads, or the way their scope looks. Having certain verbiage, if allowed, within their scope, whereas with R2v3, it is really specific. It is defined by the code of practice. It's meant to show more easily at a glance exactly what an R2v3 certified facility is doing to help with downstream due diligence qualification, advertising, a number of other things, to be able to look at the scope and have them be more consistent from one facility to another. But this is still something that our clients are getting used to, our auditors are getting used to. So I encourage you to take a look at the code of practices if you have not already done so. This is not verbiage that we as a certification body are forcing on our clients. This is a requirement of the code of practice itself. Another big adjustment with R2v3 are the deadlines and expectations for closing NCRs. These can also be found within the code of practice. So before I sound like a broken record, I just want to reiterate, if you're not already familiar with the code of practice itself, if you haven't explored that document, if you've really only reviewed the standard and the rec, I highly, highly encourage you to download a copy of the code of practices or pull it up on the CRE website and review it, because this is where a number of requirements that our clients are subject to come from, and they trickle down through PJR as the certification body, but it's helpful to know where these requirements are coming from. Audit time calculation is called out in the code of practice, closure of NCRs, the scope verbiage, the facility schemes to ensure whether it's a campus or a common parent or a, let's see what else, single facility scheme. There's a whole number of new scheme options, specific to R2v3 that would be helpful for you to become familiar with. So getting back to the NCR closure expectations, new to R2v3, all findings, minors and majors, written against the R2v3 standard require a revisit to close. Those revisits can potentially be virtual, but they cannot be off-site. And there are differences in the timelines for closure. So the code of practice specifies deadlines, typically 60 days. Some deadlines are 90 days for example, a stage two finding to have a revisit within 90 days. There are deadlines associated with like the 6 month mark. It varies by audit type. And then PJR has its own expectations or requirements, which may match the code of practice or may actually be more stringent than the code of practice to better align with our internal practices or our other deadlines for the other standards to which we audit. So the NCR closure expectations are called out in the code of practice. The revisit being required for all findings is one of the most common surprises, I would say, for our clients, which indicates, that they're not very familiar with the code of practice or familiar at all. So I do encourage you to review the code of practices. The 60-day deadline is for the evidence of correction implementation. So the idea that you have to implement changes to directly address the NCR itself. It can't hang out there open for a year. You can't have a plan of what you'll do, and then the idea that we'll check it a year later at your next audit. You actually need to implement and address the finding itself within a specified amount of time. Similarly, the corrective action also needs to be implemented, and this would be the scope of the revisit to ensure that the corrective action has been implemented and is effective. So take a look at the code of practices, but I wanted to share that as a heads up if you were not already aware of some of those changes. I mentioned the facility schemes earlier, and then again just now in terms of the code of practice, it affects audit time as well, and the relationship between different facilities is important, not only for audit time, but also the way we approach auditing. So get familiar with that as well. Virtual audits are called out in the code of practice as well as in some of the advisories or supporting information that SIRI publishes. Under the R2v3 code of practices, certain audit types are allowed to be virtual if a client's a good candidate, while others are not permitted to be virtual at all. So for R2v3, stage two audits need to be on site. All of the R2v3 time needs to be on site. Recertification audits to R2v3 after a client has transitioned or achieved certification must be on site. At least one of the two surveillance audits per cycle need to be on site, even if the client is a good virtual candidate. So there are a lot of requirements there. Significant changes may preclude a client from being eligible from virtual auditing. To see that we have been on site to verify those changes, facility moves are addressed in the code of practice and affect the auditing practices as well. So at a high level, those are some of the lessons learned that I wanted to share with you. I've kept, as with our other R2v3 webinars, I've kept an overview of the certification process in the slides for clients pursuing initial certification. You can certainly review the content of these by downloading a copy of the slides, but I do want to allow for time for questions, so I'm just going to breeze through these. I've included some of the steps for certification. If you're achieving, again, that initial registration, not talking transitioning from R2 2013 to R2 V3, covered what some of those audit activities include, again, reiterating the need for stage two audits to be on site. And if you have not already typed your questions, please go ahead and do so now. Hang out in case anyone's typing. So far, we actually don't have any questions. As I mentioned earlier, a recording of today's slides and copies of the slides will be available on PJR's website. And we will continue to maintain the content of this webinar as we continue to audit to R2v3 and see shifts in the trends. If you have a transition audit coming up, I hope it's helpful. If you have an initial registration coming up, I hope it gives you an idea of where to maybe focus or double check your processes and controls. Feel free to send me an email. I'm going to put my contact slide up here on the next slide. Feel free to send me an email if you'd like to discuss a more facility-specific topic or example offline. We can do that. Okay, otherwise, So we have a question about NAID audits. Would a NAID audit be compliant as an independent data audit? We have in R2v3 requirements for audits in Core 7, but also Appendix B. So it would depend on what type of audit you're referring to and exactly what the scope of the audit included. I know there was an article published by Siri, or maybe it was a Q&A, on the knowledge base that linked appropriate trainings for the auditor to assess whether the person conducting the data audit was meeting the requirements or the intent of the standard. So depending on the type of audit you are referring to, I would take a look at the specific requirements in the standard as well as the knowledge base to see if the NAID audit report you're talking about would fulfill the requirements. Those would be my first steps in assessing that question. Another question, if the downstream vendor is R2-2013, but it is not R2-V3 at the moment of my audit, is it considered not R2 certified facility? Yes. So if you take a look at Advisory 22, which covers the transition, that addresses the status of a downstream vendor, whether they would count as R2 or non-R2. It specifies that if they have had their transition audit, it doesn't necessarily require that they've gotten their certificate yet, but they have to have at least completed their R2-V3 transition to be considered an R2 facility. If they are still R2-2013 and their transition audit has not taken place yet, yes, they would be considered non-R2 as far as Appendix A is concerned. I don't see any other questions coming through. So feel free to send me an email if you think of something after the presentation or if there's something specific to your facility that you'd like to discuss offline. Otherwise, I hope the contents are helpful. We'll keep the webinar updated. Feel free to circle back and listen to it again in the future. And good luck with your upcoming R2-V3 audits.